As Beverly mentioned, the title of the talk is Getting Ready for the Fall, but considering the time of year, some of you might have thought that I was talking about, you know, getting into autumn, because in Atlanta, by the end of September, if it's 90 degrees plus like it was last week, we are all done with the heat and the humidity and getting in your car thinking it's like a sauna. We kind of like the looking forward to the cold, crisp mornings like today, this kind of thing, beautiful day. But I want to give you a little bit of history here, and I'll go through it fairly quickly. Why do they call it the fall? Very interesting, okay? You could ask somebody, very few people know, but we're actually referring to a very old idea here, one that took hold actually thousands of years ago. You see, most of us know the scientific stuff. On September 21st, all the days and all the nights are exactly equal in time all over the world in the northern and southern hemisphere. Everybody aware of that? That's what the equinox means, whether the spring or the fall equinox. But for the rest of the year, in the northern hemisphere anyway, the days start to get shorter and shorter until they become the shortest of the year when, a little before Christmas, December 21st, and then they start all that again, okay? So in that time period where the days go from being equal to being shorter and shorter and shorter, we are sort of falling towards the winter. That's where the term fall came from. Now, most of us go, oh, yeah, that's mildly interesting, but we don't think about it much, except as it affects our vacation plans and our heating bills and this kind of stuff, because we know that this is a normal cycle. It's science, it's the law, it's the heat and humidity of August, slowly turning into the cold and the dark of January, and then changing back again. We know that's what's going to happen. But the fact is, for thousands of years, even though the cycle of the seasons had existed far before civilization, had, ancient people looked at the seasons with much more concern than we do today with the world of heating and air, central heating and air and all the other stuff. Around the time of the harvest for the ancient people, which was September, October, that period, whatever they happened to call it, as the warm days started to end and the dark started to get sort of creeping in and the days started getting a little shorter, people began to be afraid. Every single year. They were afraid for a lot of good reasons, too. They didn't know if there'd be enough food to last them through the winter. They didn't know if there'd be enough wood for the fire. They didn't know if disease was going to come into the village, which it often did. But the most frightening thing of all for them, since these scientifically unsophisticated people did not understand the seasons and the laws and all these kind of things, they were concerned that the power that controlled all of this stuff, the harvest and the heat and the cold and the snow and all these kind of things, would change his or her mind and not let the sun come back again. That was a very real fear. So the people figured out a way to handle this. At the end of the year, as things started getting colder, they figured out these very elaborate rituals that their priests and their shamans came up with and taught to them to make sure that God was happy, because they knew that if God wasn't happy, ain't nobody going to be happy. It was probably a pretty good rule. So as they harvested the crops in the fall, they set aside a little bit of the stuff from what they did, and they gave that, saved it for the gods because of what they had done for them throughout the year. That's where our concept of Thanksgiving actually comes from. And as the year fell to a close, as the nights started getting shorter and shorter, they started setting up specific times, specific rituals that were sometimes 3, 5, even 10 days long, where they would sacrifice their best cattle and the virgins and all the other things they did back in the old days and beg the gods to let the sun come back one more time. And eventually it did, strangely enough. So they figured everything we did must have worked. Must have worked. So the following year, what did they do? They did it again. Every Western religion did this in some way or another. And today, all of those different rituals they had to beg God to let the sun come back have been replaced in our modern sophisticated society by Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. All these end of the year darkness changes. Now, to us, this sounds like superstition, because we were all raised, we went to school where we learned about the revolutions around the sun and the earth tilting on the axis and all those kind of things. So we understand that the changing of the seasons is a very normal thing. But with these people, if they had a particularly bad winter, they figured the gods must be angry, so they even increased their rituals. And the rituals turned into religion and became a very, very powerful part of their culture and their society. The problem was they were confusing cause and effect. And we talk a lot here about the law of cause and effect in terms of our consciousness being cause and our life being the effect. So what they were doing is they were reshaping their lives and their cultures and their societies with religion to keep some terrible thing from happening, thinking that what they were doing was affecting these laws. But we realize today that the thing they feared so much that they thought they were controlling with their rituals, which was the disappearance of the sun, was pretty likely not to happen. And if it did in fact happen for some reason, nothing they did in their temples or on their altars was going to change anything, because we're talking about science. Now, it's a little bit of history, and now let me tell you why that is relevant. As human beings, we have a long history of shaping our lives, sometimes in very complicated ways, to fit beliefs that we have that are based on fear, which is exactly what these people were doing. And I'm not just talking about people who have a regularly pessimistic attitude, oh, the worst is always going to happen. We all know people like that in our own lives. But people who have that kind of chronic pessimism who come into this teaching usually either lose it after they start paying attention to better ideas, and some of them are very happy to have lost it, or they leave. Sometimes because, well, this sounds really wonderful, but it's probably not going to work for me. That's the kind of consciousness they have. And as I once came up with in a talk that, or from something I heard from Kennedy Schultz, my teacher, he said they knew it wouldn't work for them, but because they believed it wouldn't, it didn't. All right? You want me to say that again? Okay. They go, what? Okay. They knew it wouldn't work for them, and because they believed it wouldn't, it didn't. All right? So chew on that a little bit and think about it. Instead, I'm talking about something here that's a lot more insidious, okay, and in the long run, a lot more hazardous to our spiritual health. I'm talking about the beliefs that we have that are so deep-seated in race consciousness that most of us, including the most open-minded and optimistic metaphysicians, don't even question them. That's what we're talking about. And some of these beliefs are even more dangerous because they make perfect sense if you don't think about them too much, and because everybody else believes that they're true. That's why we have some of these beliefs. Many of these beliefs, some of them anyway, have the strong support of the scientific and medical community. Some of them we learned in school, starting with the first grade. Some of them we learned from our parents or our grandparents or our family. These are the kind of beliefs we have that our mother reminds us of every time we call her up. They're the beliefs our coworkers talk about in the break room. They're the beliefs that we see on CNN or we read in the internet. These are these logical and rational beliefs that are accepted without question by a lot of rational, intelligent people. And sometimes they're backed by historical experience and scientific evidence. So these are what the world calls facts. All right? But there's one more thing about these beliefs that we need to understand. And that is, for some of these beliefs, if we accept them without question as the truth in our life, either consciously or unconsciously, then they will limit us to a life that's no better than the average person on the street. And believe me, that is not the kind of life that most of us would like to live. You see, some of these beliefs can cause us to avoid wonderful life experiences that are ours for the asking. Some of us can cause us to guard our pennies very, very closely while we've got $100 bills blowing by our ears. Some of us can cause us to stay inside on a glorious autumn or winter day because we're afraid that we're going to catch cold. And some of them can cause us to hide our love behind a closed door while we ignore all the amazing opportunities for love that the world has to offer. Now, some of these ideas are very socially acceptable, but they can be spiritually destructive. And whether or not they affect your life or my life is a matter of individual choice. Because until we examine all the beliefs that are thrown at us and we start to look for the greater truth that lies behind them, we're never going to be able to go beyond them and create a life that expresses the divine power to create life that we all have within us, all of us. So here's the question today. Are you living your life in some way, shape, or form getting ready for the fall? That's the question. And by that I mean, are you living, so let's just keep an open mind here, are you living any aspect of your life today limited by beliefs that you have accepted and integrated into your life at such a deep fundamental level that you never question them? Do you have beliefs that you don't question? Are there things that you anticipate in the future, because you've heard so much about them, that you fear so much you will go to any means to try to avoid them or try to keep them from happening? And this is the last part, it's kind of a three-part question. Are you doing this not because you're afraid of the consequences, but because you've convinced yourself that it's the rational and intelligent thing to do? So that's a fairly complex question, so let's get into that. Let me give you a historical example. Some of you are familiar with. For hundreds of years, back around starting about 1,000 years ago, a little less, the maps of the known world, and they actually had mapped a lot of the known world pretty well, they had vast areas around the edges that had never been explored. And maybe you've heard this. In those areas, they had a statement written. And anybody know what it was? Here be dragons. You ever hear that? In the places they had never seen, here be dragons. Because at the time, anyone with any sense knew that anyone who sailed into these uncharted areas where no one had ever been before would not only not come back, they would probably suffer some horrible fate that no one could possibly survive, like falling off the edge of the world. Everybody believed this. Kings, queens, commoners, scientists, engineers, priests, all of them. That was what everybody believed. But eventually, as we know now from our perspective, a few very brave people decided that their desire for fame or fortune or opportunity was greater than the unproven fear of the unknown that society accepted without question. So these brave people stepped through the fear, not just their own, but the fear of society, and sailed out on a very big ocean in very tiny, teeny wooden ships, as we know, in spite of their fears. And in the process, they discovered vast continents filled with people and things that had been there all the time. They had been there all the time. That's how science and civilization have always advanced. The so-called new worlds that were discovered were actually there all the time. It was only fear or ignorance that keeps them hidden, which tells us that there are a lot more things hidden by our fear and our limited beliefs than are ever hidden in nature. You see, once one single person begins to express a changed consciousness, a consciousness of curiosity, that's very important, a consciousness of courage to confront the fears of other people, a consciousness of excitement, or what we might call passion in some ways, places and possibilities, whether it's an invention or another country, that had always been there, now become something the whole world can experience because of one person, one single person. Now, it isn't just nations or races or cultures that tend to limit themselves through these. This same principle happens with individuals all the time. A story that came to mind for me was a number of years ago, I lived in an old neighborhood in Atlanta. I love the old neighborhoods here in our beautiful city. I lived right up Peachtree Street. Peter, where you live? Sherwood Forest, Gary, that area. And most of the people had lived there since the early 1950s. It was the first house they had owned. So the people, this was around the late 90s and early 2000s. Most of them had lived there for 50 years. It was so funny, a number of them, their spouses had died, so they married one of their neighbors, both spouses. It was that kind of a little incestuous, fun little neighborhood, you know. Most of them were in their 80s, and some of these 85-year-old women could knock back shots of whiskey during the parties like you wouldn't believe. Absolutely amazing. It was a fun neighborhood to live in at the time. The first woman in Georgia to ever get a pilot's license lived in that neighborhood. One of the bridesmaids at the Woodruff wedding lived in that neighborhood. All these very fascinating people once you got to talk to them, all right? However, there was a relatively young couple in the neighborhood, late 40s, early 50s, very nice, friendly people, man and woman, very well-educated people in great health, who one day put a for sale sign out in their front yard. And for sale signs never went out. These houses sold before anybody even knew they were for sale. And a week later, maybe less, they sold it and they moved to a much smaller home in the burbs. I think it was Snellville or somewhere up in that direction. And that was a very big surprise because not many people ever left that neighborhood unless it was to go to Patterson's, which is the funeral home nearby, if you're not familiar with that. So when I asked the realtor, who was another neighbor who had lived there a while, who had sold their house for him, why they had done it, she said they had told her, this is great, they wanted to get rid of the house before they were too old and sick to take care of it. In their late 40s, perfectly healthy. And this was considered, this is what was interesting to me, by some people to be perfectly logical, rational thinking. Very, very interesting, all right? So let's talk about how this kind of thinking affects us in other areas of our lives. There are a number of people today, thankfully not as many as there were a number of years ago, perfectly healthy people in the prime of their life who are afraid to get involved with anyone in a loving, caring relationship because of their fear of contracting some sort of a disease that might hurt them. There are still people like that. And are these people neurotic? Well, a few of them are, I admit. But not most of them. Most of them are perfectly intelligent people who are simply overwhelmed by the beliefs that they hear expressed in the news media about the spread of things like HIV and all these other things. And they decided to cut off that portion of their life to avoid having to deal with that possible problem. The problem is when they encounter someone who is attractive or interesting, who they might really enjoy being with, instead of seeing it as a possibility to experience love or friendship, they run away home to hide in their safe little cocoon because of the dangers that falling in love might pose for them. They live their life avoiding love at all costs, avoiding those kind of problems. And the cost of life without love is very, very high. Now, people do the same thing with their money. That's pretty popular right now. They put together a few extra dollars, maybe retirement savings. They get a little inheritance, something. And suddenly they are paralyzed by all the doomsday scenarios that they hear about thrown at them from every single angle. They're told the savings and loans are falling. The banks are going to fail. Bonds are dangerous, all this kind of stuff. And all these views are coming from very respectable sources. All the financial experts. They have entire TV channels dedicated to people who tell you what to be afraid of in terms of your money. And they have very high ratings. That's what's very, very interesting. So what these people do is, because they're hearing all these fear stories, is they do some equivalent of stuffing the money in their mattress, whether it's a safety deposit or whatever it is, and they buy some expensive deadbolts and a real high-powered alarm system to make sure nobody steals it. That's what they do. They don't invest it because they're scared to. They don't share it because there might not be enough when they retire. And they don't buy some things that they would actually enjoy in their life for the same reason. So they end up living a limited life in an okay apartment, whatever it is, feeling safe from all those unspecified fears and dangers that may or may not happen in the future. You see it all the time. You see, it's easy to live our lives reacting to the fears of the world. Every time a new danger shows up in the news, and start keeping track of them, write them down just to keep yourself aware of what the world is trying to get you to think. Every time a new fear comes up, we alter our life in some little way. We don't expose ourselves to something that might or might not happen down the road. And the list keeps getting longer. Terrorism is a big one right now. I can't travel to this country because they have terrorists. I can't go to that place because they're having this kind of a problem. Asbestos, that's a big one. You remember radon? Everybody was afraid of radon, okay, whatever that is. Zika, that's a new one, okay? Can't go to Brazil, can't go to the Olympics. Zika, it's all over the news. And those are just the health hazards. I mean, what about on the work front, okay? People spend 30 years in a job that they absolutely hate because they have been warned that they won't be able to get insurance, or that somebody their age or their gender or their field might not be able to get another job. So they spend 30 years, 40 hours a week, driving an hour and a half each direction from wherever they're living, doing a job that's killing their soul because they're afraid. You know, that kind of thinking, to me at any rate, doesn't make sense because in terms of this spirituality, it doesn't fit my idea of a life that is supported unconditionally by a divine intelligence. That's simply the reason to me that it doesn't work. I mean, there are too many people in the world living their lives afraid of making a big mistake. They're afraid if they fall down in life, so to speak, they won't be able to get back up. So to keep from falling, what they do is they stand in one place and they stand holding the guardrail really, really hard while the world just passes them by. While the world just passes them by. Remember when you learned to ride a bicycle? Everybody? I think we all do. Okay. If you fell down, what did you do? You got up and you tried it again. Even if you scraped your knee or you bumped your head, and I promise you, I did a lot of scraping and bumping and I was learning. Because as a child, this just seems natural. It just seems natural. We had fears, but we looked around and we saw all these kids having so much fun on these bicycles, doing all these amazing things. Back then, they didn't have the jumps and all that, but now they do. And we knew that we could do it, so we did. So we did, no questions. But years later, as adults, we listened very, very carefully, all right, to all the scientific and medical and financial experts to justify why we can have the fears we have, to justify our fears, okay? And meanwhile, while that's happening and we're holding on to the guardrails, we see people all around us, on the internet, on television, on Facebook, you see a lot of it there, who are doing amazing, incredible things, traveling to absolutely fantastic places. We see people living lives that are full of health and love and prosperity and all those wonderful things. We see these people and we say, gee, I'd like to do that, but I can't. What if I spend money I'm going to need? What if I contract some sort of a disease? What if I, you know, something yada, yada, yada. That's the reason that Wordsworth, the poet, had a great quote that most of you have heard, many of you have heard, I used to love. It said, surely a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? Our reach has to exceed our grasp. I mean, there are so many people in the world who have a desire for success, but an expectation of failure. There are people in the world who have a desire for prosperity, but they have an expectation of loss. There are people in the world who have a desire for love, but they have an expectation of getting hurt. Now, they say they believe that God supports them, and they believe that the law supports them and all that stuff, but they don't think it works for them. They just don't believe that. They have dreams. Everybody's got dreams, but they never follow through. They never follow through. We have to remember that spirit acts in our life based on our expectations, not our dreams, not our desires. Desires and dreams are important. They give us focus. They give us a little energy to get started, but we have to do more than that. We have to do more than just dream or desire. We have to accept our dreams completely to embody them as the truth in our consciousness. We need to see them as possible. We need to see them as imminent. That is, they're going to show up very, very quickly. And then we may have to take some action. We'll probably have to take some action. And sometimes that action entails risk. That's why a friend of mine, a minister out in California, I love it, one of my favorite quotes that I've heard in a talk, he said, our dreams are waiting for us to come true. Our dreams are waiting for us to come true. That's not mine. You can use it. Feel free. Okay. Now, falling doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, think about it from a baby bird's perspective. You're in the nest, you popped out of the egg, and the nest is there, and mama shows up, and daddy, and bringing food. Everything's fine. Everything's hunky-dory. They're protecting you. Everything's all great. And one day, mama shows up, and she doesn't have a worm in her mouth. And she sort of nudges you up to the edge of the thing, and she says, have fun, sweetheart. She gives you a little push. So as you're plummeting towards the ground, you know, plummeting, suddenly something happens. You remember what your wings are for. You remember what your wings are for. And right in the middle of a fall, you end up flying for the rest of your life. For the absolute rest of your life. It's a great analogy, a great analogy. So, let's talk for a minute in closing this. How do we incorporate these kind of ideas into our life? Because we like to say this is a practical teaching. How do we use these kind of principles to not only keep from living in fear, That's one part. But to look past other people's fears that they're trying to thrust upon us. How do we do that? So we can see a greater truth, so we can see a greater idea. Well, first and foremost, we have to do something that we talk about here all the time. We have to remember that God is all there is. God is all there is. And we may know this on an intellectual level, but we have to know it on a deeper level. We have to know it on a soul level, or what we might call a gut level or a visceral level. All right? Because what it means is that everything that ever happened to us, or everything that ever will happen to us, is God or Spirit expressing itself in the world. That's all it is. That's all it is. It is God as love and law expressing itself as life. And God, we have to remember, is the power that makes all things new. It is the power that makes all things new. So there's nothing that can happen in our life that we can't change for the better. There's nothing that can happen in our life that we can't recover from. We are creative, intelligent beings with divine power that has no limits. We are not created to live in limitation or fear. Now, Beverly talked about this a little bit. It's perfectly normal when we're going through some big change in our life that we may feel kind of like we're walking a wire without a net. You ever feel like that in your life? If you did, how many have ever felt that way in your life? Good. Okay. You're never without a net. You know what the net is? The net is God. The net is the creative power of life. So we never have to be afraid of falling. I mean, if you ever talk to someone or listen to an interview of someone who is a professional wire walker, like Carl Walenda, the Flying Walendas and all that, they will all tell you without exception that when you're on the wire, you're far better off looking ahead of you at the goal than looking down at the ground wondering what the hell is going to happen if I fall. Okay? Far better off. So in our life, we need to believe that we are supported in creating whatever life we are willing to accept for ourselves. So if we're willing to accept whatever kind of life we accept for ourselves, we need to be very sure that we are choosing to believe in a life of success, of love, of prosperity, of health, of all these different things, and know that nothing can keep us from it. Nothing can keep us from it. Now, the good news is, when we start thinking that way, unconsciously, automatically, we get to the point that that is our default mode, how we think, something very wonderful happens. As we fill our mind with beliefs that expand our life, with beliefs that support our growth, with beliefs that support our dreams, all of the fears and all of the false beliefs and the doomsday scenarios that once filled our heads will start to fall away. We'll be replacing them with something better. And as we become more and more aware of what we are thinking about on a daily basis, we can begin to accept the truth that other people's realities do not need to be ours. Other people's beliefs do not need to be ours. That's what affirmative prayer does, or spiritual mind treatment, as we call it. It replaces society's fears with a greater truth that will show up in our life to the degree that we believe it and accept it. That's the only purpose of affirmative prayer. We are life expressing as us. We say something similar to that. And it's always the nature of life to change. And how we deal with that change is going to determine how we grow. Now, sometimes the changes are unexpected and we have to adapt, but we're capable of doing that. We are part of the creative power of life. We have this infinite intelligence that's ours to use. If we constantly fear that something bad's going to happen to us, that everything's going to fall apart, that's what we'll attract, because that's what we are putting into consciousness. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to do that, because there is a much better way, and I promise you from experience that this teaching will show you how to do it, because this is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is. Thank you. All right. Let's just take a few moments. Take a breath or two. A lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts. Take the ones that resonated with you. Set aside the others for later. And let's know this. Life is inherently an incredible experience. Incredible experience. I see evidence of this everywhere I look. I don't have to listen to other people to know what's possible. I only have to look at those who are accomplishing great things. I don't have to listen to other people about where I should travel because I have access to everywhere in the world. All the amazing sights and sounds, all the wonderful entertainment I can experience, all the wonderful beauty that I can see. I can do all these things because I am here and I am a part of life. So I consciously choose to focus my mind on ideas that support me and support the world. I surround myself with positive, loving people. I allow my mind to be filled with good, high-quality ideas. I do not allow myself to be disillusioned by what other people think can't be done. As I grow and increase my life, as I deal with my family, my parents, my children, my siblings, I recognize that I am a center. I am a center of consciousness, and I consciously choose to make my life better and the world better for everyone. As I do this, I do exactly what every other person in the world is capable of doing, but I choose to do for myself, and that is to live life to the utmost. That is to look at the world through eyes that see the world as God sees it, to be in the world with the peace of God, of life, in everything I do, to not speak badly of anyone, to not focus on the negative, to not believe that anything bad or sad cannot be changed. And as I do this, I become more and more of who and what I truly am, which is life evolving, which is life expanding, which is life becoming more and more alive every moment. Knowing this, I give thanks for the opportunities that I have to experience life. I give thanks for all that I have been given and all that I have yet to give. And knowing this, accepting this as my truth and the truth for every other person, I place these ideas firmly in consciousness, knowing that they will return to me completely fulfilled now and always. Please join me in saying, and so it is.